for starting the show.
Hi, everybody.
And
we're live.
These
Casey
clips.
Won't stop talking.
No, I won't stop talking. It's the first time for everything. Should we play these clips right now just so I'm sure I'm here? I'm locked in. I'm watching your reaction. Well, not
what?
Really, because there's no video.
The Power Broker clips?
Yes.
No, that's not part of this show.
I'm just messing with you. Relax. I'm
oh,
just
my
kidding.
God.
I guess that the clips you put in is the one about building the road on Fire Island. And
correct. That was
it.
The second one. The first one was how apparently, so the context
is him in his house. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is not for the release version of the show. Hi, bootleg people. But apparently Robert Moses, of whom I know almost nothing, but I'm 99% Invisible, which is a wonderful podcast, is doing a book club, if you will, and reading The Power Broker. And they interviewed Robert Caro for this episode.
Who is they, Casey?
Roman Mars and Elliot something or other.
Yeah. Where is he from?
Somewhere in New York. I'm assuming your hometown.
No, the Flop House.
Oh, okay. I've never heard.
He is
Flop
one
House.
Of the three hosts of the Flop House.
Never
that,
heard
a bad movie podcast that I've been listening to for 17 years. Anyway,
I'm aware. I just didn't realize that was the same Elliot. But anyways, point being, there were a couple of clips. One about Robert Moses apparently built his house on the some edge, and Marco, or both of you actually would know probably exactly where this is. But allegedly, apparently, it was like on the edge. I'm going to get these details wrong. On the edge of Robert Moses Park, looking at the Robert Moses Causeway, Expressway, whatever it's called, by the Robert Moses Tower or something like that. Which Marco did listen to before we recorded under much coercion from me. And then the second one was, like you said, John, apparently Moses wanted to build a like freeway, causeway, highway, whatever, interstate through Fire Island. And
the length of Fire Island,
which, first of all, for much of Fire Island, it's not even wide enough to do.
That's exactly
the point.
That
point is made in the podcast. That's the thing about this podcast. Like, so Robert Caro has been, this book was written in the 70s. Robert Caro has been doing interviews about this book since the 70s. He's now 80 something years old. And I've heard him tell these same stories like over many decades. They're still good. It's still great to hear him. He's slowing down in his old age. But yeah, if you want to hear various younger versions of Robert Caro telling you the same stories, just go to YouTube. You can find them.
Anyway, I do plan to read the book. I was bemoaning and lamenting earlier before we went live that at my local library, which I cannot say enough good things about our local libraries, truly, but apparently they do not have enough copies of this book because I'm hold number 6 and I've been on the hold list for, I don't know, at least a month now. So I'm very sad. And there's no eBooks, apparently. Let's just say I'm a man who knows how to get things, and there apparently do not exist good eBooks of this book. So I was very sad about
even,
that.
Even
buy the paper
getting,
book.
Even
I believe
your
in
getting
you.
Things skill aside, like, reading on once you get used to reading on an e-reader, reading paper books sucks.
Agreed. That's why I don't want the damn paper book.
But this is the one time you're supposed to read in a paper book so everyone can be impressed by the fact that you're reading The Power Broker.
Yeah. See, that's
why everyone's
really
got in the
like
background
kind of
all attention. Their Zoom, you know, when they're doing Zoom meetings, you got to have your 15 copies of The Power Broker behind you. Which, like, right. I know I'm saying that, and I know I have one that's prominently displayed anytime I do video, but I came by mine honestly, and that it's the first edition of the Power Broker.
Oh, you liked the band before they were cool.
I literally have and read the first edition of the Power Broker. Unfortunately, my first edition is on the top shelf where it's being preserved. It's kind of beat up because my dad also read it, and he's not careful. It's his book. I read it after him.
Sorry, Dad.
But because it was beat up, I'm like, you know what? I should get a second copy of that is in better condition. So I have a paperback one, and that's the one that shows up on video, and people think, look at this guy with his paperback version of the Power Broker. I'm like, I've got a first edition. I read it decades ago. I'm not like you.
You can't sit with us.
I liked hating Robert Moses before it was cool.
Oh, cheesy peasy. All right. This is my fault. We are already derailed. It's 100% my fault.
Yep.
But let's bring this back around. All right. So, John, I hear we have some YouTube updates you would like to share with the class.
Yeah. As we said last episode, YouTube has a thing where they'll read your podcast RSS feed and make little quote unquote videos out of each podcast episode. There's nothing in the video except for the logo of the show. There is no actual video component, but at least the audio is there. And we did that because it's, you know, it doesn't require anything of us. It's just an RSS feed like any other podcast, and YouTube, you know, consumes it and does this. It's like, great. Because we know some people like to use, for whatever reason, they like to use YouTube to listen to audio. And so now they can with our podcast. A few updates on that. First is that YouTube will import the quote unquote descriptions of the video from the RSS feed. So basically our show notes that have all our links, YouTube will import that. Our show notes are in HTML. The YouTube podcast RSS ingestion thing I don't know what it's doing, but it ends up taking our HTML and turning it into plain text filled with tons and tons of blank lines. It looks awful. I don't know what it's doing. I mean, obviously, it extracts all the URLs and puts them out longhand in the thing, so there's no, like, link that you don't know where it's going to go. Everything is HTTP colon. Like, you can see the URL. So it does that with the links, which also lengthens it a little bit. But then it put tons of blank space in there. So I wrote an automation to get rid of all the blank space. But then the second problem was, if my automation didn't run fast enough to sort of slim down the show notes to get rid of all the blank spaces, sometimes they were too long and YouTube would truncate them for us helpfully by just cutting them off. Apparently YouTube can host petabytes of video. I forget what the absurd number is, like how many gigs of YouTube videos are uploaded per second. It's some ridiculous number. But the descriptions are limited to 5,000 characters because they don't want to waste space. You really have to think about the space efficiency. You know, if you let everybody put, I don't know, like 4 kilobytes of text in there, what's going to happen? And so I was fighting with that with my automation. And then someone suggested that wouldn't it be great if YouTube, when they ingested the RSS feed, would also understand our chapters, because we put chapters in the podcast, because YouTube now supports chapters. Wouldn't it be great if they could just take our chapters and stick them in there? And so all of this conspired to make me eventually decide, you know what, I'm just going to put a link to the show notes. So it just says show notes colon https://atp.fm/1234. And then you can just get to the show notes that way, and they'll be correctly formatted, and you'll see all of them, and they'll never be truncated. Well, then the chapter stuff turned out to be super easy, because I was already had a script that was modifying the description. Apparently, the way chapters work on YouTube is you just put some text in the description that looks like a chapter list.
YouTube
parses that.
Timestamps as text. Yeah.
Yep. That's it. Yeah, that's literally, that. You just... Right? That's their system. And so I'm like, oh, great. So now I know what all the show notes will be. So I'll just replace all the show notes with show notes, colon, link to show notes, and then chapter, 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 chapter. So for people who are listening on YouTube, now you get access to chapters too. Here's one caveat, though. To do all this, I had to use the YouTube API, which is like, you know, part of the Google, some Google developer platform. So I have to like get a Google developer account and say I want to use the YouTube data API v3 and deal with OAuth and do all sorts of crap like that. And then I'm writing my script and I'm debugging it. I'm trying to get it to work, right? And every time I did this, I've been doing this for like 4 days now, I blow through my API quota. Like there's a number of requests per day that you're allowed to use. And the first time I blew through it, I was like, I didn't know there was a quota. Well, I guess there's a quota. I'll just be more careful tomorrow, right? But every single day I've worked on this, I've blown through my quota within like less than an hour. You can, I was like, I'll just pay them money. Here, Google, here's $10. Give me more API requests. I just need this for a few days to finish development of this thing. After that, I'm not going to need a lot of requests, right? But apparently they won't take your money. So you have to request more API access. And there's this form that you fill out that's like, tell me about your application. What are you using it for? How many people are using this? Can you send us your source code? Why do you need to use this API? If you didn't use this API, what would happen? Like, they just want to know so much about you. Like, where are your parents from? How are you feeling right now? Have you ever spoken to anybody about this script? Has anyone seen this script? What are you going to use it for? It's like, just can you just give me more requests? And anyway, they came back to me today and said, can you send us the source code to the script that you use to upload your videos?
What?
For the umpteenth time, upload my videos. As I said at length last time I wrote to you and filled out your giant form, it's your feature that's reading my... I don't upload the videos. They're already there. I just want to change the descriptions. Oh, my God. It's such... They're never going to give me more requests. And anyway, final thing is, you may be wondering, why are you blowing through your API requests? Are you just doing something dumb? On the first day, I was like, I must have just, had some loop that looped too many times and burnt, when you're just writing code. I didn't know there was a limit. I probably did something dumb. But now I've realized that I have no idea how the things I'm calling relate to their API queries or whatever. Because as far as I'm aware, and I've stepped through it in the debugger, here are the calls. List videos in playlist, right? And it's 50 per page, so I got to call that 10 times because they have a paging system, right? So that's 10 requests, 10 or 11 requests to loop through all the 500 and something videos, right? But that's 5 calls to the Google API function. I'm doing this in Node, right? What I think is I'm calling a function 5 times. Maybe each one of those calls fires off 100 API requests or something. And then while I'm looping over them, the only thing I ever do is I loop over the things that I've just got from this query, each, you know, 50 at a time, right? And I look at them and say, do I need to update this description? And if I do, I call an update API once and I say, update this description, right? But somehow I blow through my daily quota of 10,000 requests within an hour. I'm like, there's no way I made 10,000 function calls. And now I'm thinking, like, is there some internal retry logic that I don't understand? Or anyway, I'm almost done with this script, but of course I can only work on it for a few hours a day before I blow through my quota. So tomorrow I get 10,000 new requests.
Hooray!
See if I can manage not to blow through all those. But I did manage today to update all the descriptions, so they're all up there and they all have chapters. Please do enjoy.
Wow.
We appreciate your service. Salute emoji. We really do appreciate your service, actually. I say that sarcastically.
By the way, here's what the limits are. Queries per minute, 1.8 million. Queries per minute per user, 180,000. Queries per day, 10,000.
What?
So you can do 1.8 million queries per minute for a fraction of a second.
and then
you're done for the day.
Oh, my word. I'm sure in some way this does make sense, but if so, I don't see it.
Oh, Google.
Well, genuinely, I know I sounded sarcastic a moment ago, but truly, I do appreciate your service, because this is a pain in the tuchus that I am pretty freaking confident I can speak for Marco in saying I would have given up on this long ago and said, hey, you should be using YouTube anyway. Tough noogies.
I would never even attempted this.
Right, exactly. So, again, we appreciate you, John. All right. We appreciate you, even though apparently you don't know what the back of a Mac looks like. Tell me about this, please.
Yeah. During our connector tier list thing, I had said that the DB50 connector was the SCSI that was on the back of the Mac. And that's not the case. It was DB25, which, of course, looks exactly like DB50, but a little bit narrower. And when things aren't really to scale on a bunch of little thumbnails, it's hard to tell. I apologize for this mistake. I think the last time I plugged in a SCSI DB25 connector was many decades ago. So what can I tell you?
We regret the error. The offending party has been sacked. John, if you haven't heard this episode and don't know what the crap it is we're talking about, what can you do?
You can go to atp.fm/join and become a member. We have these member specials that we do, and they're silly and fun. And the last one we did was ranking various computer connectors, and it was a blast. You should check it out.
Indeed. It was a lot of fun. And you definitely should check it out. And if you go to atp.fm/join, as I get a little tongue-tied over here, if you go to atp.fm/join, then you can not only get access to this member special, but all the member specials that preceded. And at this point, we're building up a fair catalog is the word I was looking for. And so you might want to check those out, atp.fm/join. Awesome. Screen sharing. We were talking about how to help perhaps a relative that is a bit older and less tech savvy, or maybe just someone who in general who is less tech savvy. And John, you said something that I would have called you on had I realized that you were wrong, but I thought you were exactly right. It turns out we were both wrong, because as it turns out, iOS does have screen sharing. Can you tell me about this, please?
Yeah, some people are saying this was rolled out in iOS 15, although I think it might be older than that. I'm not sure when it rolled out. But yes, you can do screen sharing in iOS, but screen sharing in the way of they can share their screen with you so you can see it, which, don't get me wrong, is very helpful, but you can't control it. I didn't think there was any way to control it, but then someone named Jenger said there's no remote control unless you're on the same Wi-Fi network with the same Apple ID and switch control is enabled. Well, those things are probably not going to be the case if you're trying to help a relative, because if you're on the same Wi-Fi network, then just walk over and help them with their thing, right? And the same Apple ID, they're probably not using your Apple ID. So it's interesting to know that that is possible to remote control it under this narrow circumstance, but with regular screen sharing, all you can do is see their screen and then just try to talk them through it, which is, again, way better than not being able to see their screen. But the beauty of the Mac one is you just get to take over, because a lot of the times they're not interested in learning how to fix it or what went wrong. They just want you to fix their computer. And that is made so much easier by just, hit the accept button and now I've got control of your computer and I'll fix it for you and you're done.
Indeed. All right. We had a fair bit of feedback about r/my rant about Apple and their 30%. And I think, John, you had maybe not corrections, but some notes you would like to add.
Yeah, obviously, we've talked about this topic tons and tons of times in the past. And very often when we talk about it for the 15th or 16th time, we don't reiterate all the same things. I know it sounds like we do, but we don't actually say all the same things that we said last time. And then people write in to tell us about them. And in this case, we get a lot of people coming back to say, The fee that Apple charges for its in-app purchases, whether it's 30% or 27% or whatever, that's not for payment processing. So I don't know why you were talking about Stripe and how much they charge and that they would make a replacement in-app purchase thing or whatever, because Apple's not charging you for payment processing. They're charging you for access to their intellectual property, you know, hosting and distribution, marketing, whatever thing people thought like we would explain to us. And then presumably we would hear them and say, oh, we hadn't thought of that. You're right. They should get 30%. And obviously the Stripe comparison, because Stripe is a payment processor. Like what we were saying is Stripe would do all the same things Apple does in terms of APIs and so on and so forth, right? But here's the thing, and this is the reason I keep mentioning and linking my stupid blog post about this that apparently is not clear enough for people to understand what I'm saying. Or maybe they just don't read it, which, you know, fair enough. But the thing is, it doesn't really matter what Apple thinks the 30% is for, or what you think the 30% is for, or what the 30% is actually for, or whether it's for payment processing, whether it's for access to intellectual property, or it's this, that, the other thing. None of that matters. The only thing that matters is, how do people feel about paying the 30%? The people who have to pay the 30%, how do they feel about paying for it? Do they feel like, that's a fair price? Or do they feel terrible about it and they resent it? And it's fair for you to try to convince somebody who resents the 30% that they shouldn't be resentful. Maybe they just didn't know that they're actually paying for access to Apple's intellectual property. And maybe you think you can convince them, and then they will feel okay with it, right? But I can tell you that all the arguments put forward by people saying, here's what Apple's 30% really is for, have thus far not proven convincing to the developers who resent their percentage, right? And then the second thing I'll say is that Apple itself really does not spend any time at all trying to convince developers that 30% is the right amount. Like, you see much more from people who are trying to explain on Apple's behalf what they think the 30% is quote-unquote for, but how much do you see Apple making an effort to explain when they're not on the witness stand in a court case why it is that they think they should get 30%? And that, I think, might contribute to the dissatisfaction. Like, that's what it boils down to.
Well, but do you think any answer they would actually give would actually, you know, make people all of a sudden be, oh, okay, I guess I will pay it. Like, I don't think the people who don't want to pay it would be satisfied by any explanation Apple could possibly give.
But with Apple attempting to explain it, at least there would be some kind of conversation. I don't, obviously, you know, that's part of the, so here's the thing. That's why I was talking about game consoles. So Apple developers, some of them resent the 30%, right? But game console developers resent it less, right? The 30% that they pay. Not to say they don't resent it, but they resent it less. And that must seem unfair to Apple. But I would say to Apple, have you made any effort whatsoever to try to figure out the origins of dissatisfaction and talk about it? Not that you're going to be able to talk them into it or whatever, but the first step along that road is communicating about it. Whereas Apple's like, how about we just say nothing and continue to insist on 30%? And that, of course, leads to more resentment. And this doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem like, well, that's not, you're not being fair at, why do they not like it? But that's what I tried to write about in that blog post. Like, at this point, with this going on for so many years, for so long, it's clear that for whatever reason, there is resentment about the amount of money that Apple asks for. Is it fair? Is it unfair? Should people not feel that way? Should people feel that way? The fact is they do. And so far, nothing. It's been getting worse and not better. And that may seem like not right to certain people, but it is what it is. That's what the Art of the Possible post is about. It's like, you may not think it's fair, Apple. You may think you're justified, but there is resentment there. It is an unhealthy relationship that is not getting better. So something has to change if you want this resentment to go away. And that's what I would say to all the people who say, you don't understand. The 30% is not for payment processing. It's for X, Y, or Z. It doesn't matter what it's for. It only matters if people are okay with it. And people are less okay with it than Apple wants them to be. And it fosters a relationship where there's this sort of distrust and resentment between the two parties. And that has ramifications, like, for example, Division Pro launching without a Netflix, YouTube, or Spotify app on it.
Yeah, I think I talked about this a little bit on the talk show coming up soon, but I think Apple does not know how to either court developers or to negotiate when they are not in a position of power, which is basically any negotiation. That's like, because, you know, Apple, what they know how to do is dictate, and they know how to be fawned all over. But when things are actually like, when people aren't busting down the doors to get into their app stores and to you know, participate in their new platforms. They don't know what to do. They don't negotiate. They don't, like, really do a lot of outreach or you know, trying to build those relationships. All they do is manage when people come to them. And even that, it's really more of a dictation scenario.
they're very controlled in their messaging, and they don't get roped into arguments they don't want to have, which is just good PR, right? But you're right that, like, the thing I was talking about, like, they don't spend any time trying to convince people that they should feel better about the deal they're getting. That's what they don't do.
Right. And there is – they're really – like, Apple really does not – I'm convinced they really do not know how to negotiate or build those relationships, because to a large degree they never really had to. So they never, like, so much of Apple in the last, you know, 15 years or whatever, during so much of that time, they have been in the position of power in the areas that they would need this skill potentially in. So they really haven't had to use any kind of negotiation or relationship building, you know, developer outreach, you know, even developer relations is fairly minimal in its interaction with, you know, most developers. So Apple doesn't know how. They just think everyone just comes to them all the time. And they seem genuinely surprised when they put something out there and it goes kind of poorly with some people in the community or with certain developers or whatever. Like, I don't think they know what to do, because they literally do not know how to negotiate. They've never really had to in most ways. And if you look at the ways that they are not in power, it's, you know, certain, you know, app stores for lesser platforms that don't have the, you know, the massive reach that the iPhone has or whatever else. Like, if you look at, you know, certain, you know, content deals, in many of those other areas, they actually don't do very well. They don't succeed very much because they don't have this skill. So when it comes to this, you know, the 30% thing, like, they are just so accustomed to being able to dictate whatever they want for the iPhone and have people, you know, grumble and bend over backwards to accommodate them because the iPhone is such a big market, that when it comes to something like the Vision Pro launching, no wonder so many developers, especially the big companies, no wonder they're like, why should I work with you? Like, why? Like, there's not the big audience here to make it worth it. So why should I, you know, give you more power when I'm kind of tired of what you've done with your power?
And that's the Apple's usual move. Their main negotiating tactic is, well, we'll just sell as many of these as we can. If we make a good enough product, we'll make the market big enough that you'll have to pay attention to us. And that is an important strategy and a good idea. It's just made more difficult by the fact that you don't have as much help from third-party developers as you could have if you had a better relationship.
Well, that's also not negotiation. That's literally
it's a form of saying, can we make this more attractive to you, right? And one way to make it more attractive is, well, we, Apple, it's our job to make a product that people want to buy, so we'll sell a billion of them. That's on us. We'll do that, and that will make the platform more attractive to you. And it's not taking away the bad. It's not taking away the stick. It's adding some carrot, right?
Yeah, to some degree.
Anyway, one final thing on this. We also, the last episode, we were talking about the whole, hey, you want to use a link out to a third-party payment thing? You can do that, but you still have to pay us pretty much the same amount you always paid us. We talked about that last episode. I saw some discussion online of people saying, well, given all of this, given that it's just like the Dutch dating app thing or whatever, like, why would anybody choose to use a third-party payment processor? Because it just seems like more work and you pay exactly the same amount. So it's like, even if they're complying with the letter of the law, which Epic says they're not, but we'll see how that goes in court. Who would choose to do this? It's like they've given an option and they'll have zero people who want to do it. And as we've discussed many, many times in the past, but didn't mention on last episode, we will reiterate, the one remaining important motivating factor is when you send somebody through a third-party behavior processor or whatever, have them pay on your website. Unlike with the App Store, you now, quote unquote, own that customer. You know who they are. You know what they paid with. You probably have their email address. Like, when someone does something through in-app purchase, Apple owns the customer. Apple knows who they are. You don't know. You just get the money, the 70% or whatever of the money they give you, but you know nothing about them, right? That if you have the type of business where, quote unquote, owning the customer in that way is valuable, you may be willing to pay exactly the same amount as you paid before, do a lot more work, subject yourself to audits from Apple. Also, now you can own the customer. And what kind of business might it be really important that they own the customer? Probably businesses that are going to make some money on the side selling information about you or spamming you or doing other things. So yeah, there is a reason somebody, a company might want to go through these hoops to do this, even though they're paying Apple exactly the same amount. It's just to get ownership of the customer's information, all that stuff.
All right. And with that in mind, I'm happy to report that the rumblings about how Apple will handle this forthcoming EU law about sideloading is that they're going to be extremely breaking news. No, they are not going to be extremely generous. My mistake. They are going to continue to be petulant turds. According to the Wall Street Journal, which writes, Apple is planning to add new fees and restrictions when it begins allowing people to download apps outside of the iPhone's closed ecosystem. Apple's approach to the EU law will help ensure the company maintains close oversight of apps downloaded outside the App Store, a process known as sideloading. The company will give itself the ability to review each app downloaded outside of its App Store. Apple also plans to collect fees from developers, of course they are, that offer downloads outside of the App Store, said people familiar with the company's plans. Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know a lot about this yet, but I think anybody who is surprised by this... I think is not paying attention, because we have seen over and over again, here's what Apple will do. They will cling to every single penny they have and every ounce of control they have. And if a regulator or a lawmaker, passes some law that says they have to somehow give up some of their control or money in the App Store, they will do it only kicking and screaming and only the bare minimum they need to do, and they will make it as absolutely painful as possible. So with the EU DMA and forcing sideloading basically by law, I can't imagine Apple's going to just say, okay, well, I guess we have to allow it, and just throw their hands up and say, all right, done. No. We've seen they are going to make it as incredibly hostile and painful and expensive as possible, because they don't want to be doing this. And honestly, for this particular case, I feel very differently, as we talked about last week, about whether apps should be able to link out to external payments. But for sideloading and third-party app stores, I really don't think this is a great idea for iOS. I'm worried about what it could do, especially with, we don't have to imagine, it's been in the news, a Facebook app store, a Meta app store. There are so many ways that can go badly for users and developers. I really don't want that to be the case on iOS. So I'm not surprised Apple is going to be, probably very painful on this. And in this particular case, I'm not going to be upset about it. But certainly if you were hoping that they would just allow you to download something off someone's website and that'd be it, and it'd be super easy and you can totally bypass the app, the App Store review process or code signing with Apple or rules or whatever, and especially bypass, any kind of financial arrangement with Apple, I think that's only going to happen through a lot of painful lawsuits and legislation again down the road. But for now, Apple's going to do the bare minimum they can and make it so hostile and expensive that nobody will do it.
It does make me wonder, the people who are writing these laws, is this just an example of regulatory capture, where the regulated company is really running the show here because it's just a bunch of rich companies and people who are in sway to rich companies sort of arranging for them, we're going to pass this law which looks good to our people, but really behind the scenes, oh, Apple, you can just do whatever you want. You're still going to get all your money. You're still going to have all your control. It'll be fine. Just go with it. Or did they actually try to, pass this Digital Markets Act that would, increase competition for apps on the iPhone, and just did such a bad job of it that Apple's approach, as described in this rumor, complies with the letter of the law? Because if Apple's still controlling everything about it and still getting the same amount of money, how is that competition? How you haven't made the market, and what were you trying to do, EU? Is presumably you're trying to increase competition, right? People can't put their apps on the iPhone unless Apple says they can. So let's fix that by allowing Apple to decide what apps can go on and collect money. I find it hard to believe that they would have done such a terrible job that all this would be allowed. But maybe they did, and maybe it's just a bad law. Anyway, or maybe this rumor is not true, or maybe this is what Apple wants to do, but EU will say, no, that doesn't fly. We'll see how it shakes out, but it is baffling to me. But I will say one thing, just like I said before, why would anybody do this with the third-party payments? And the answer was to own a customer. There is still one thing that this EU law and this approach to satisfying it would provide that didn't exist before. And that is, and again, this is another assumption based on information we don't know. The assumption being that even though Apple gets all its money and gets to, like, you know, check the apps for malware and do whatever, still, I would assume that the whole point of this is that if you want to put an app on if you want to put an app on your own app store on the thing, and Apple doesn't want that app to be distributed, they can't stop it. So, like, if you want to put up a Nintendo emulator or some other app that Apple refuses to put in there, or you want to have a different web browser engine or something like that, right? What this would allow is, yes, Apple gets the same amount of money. Yes, Apple still does code signing. Yes, they scan for malware. But Apple can't actually stop you from putting up an iOS version of Chrome that uses the Blink engine, for example, right? If they can stop that, then this is totally pointless, and I don't know why they did it at all. But that is the one additional thing that even this terrible solution would provide. If there's an app that Apple wouldn't let you put it on an iPhone, now, in theory, you can get it on there through one of these third-party app stores, because Apple won't, I wouldn't say can't stop it, but Apple won't stop it.
Indeed. Speaking of Apple and legislative and related issues, apparently their workaround for the Massimo-related import ban on the Apple Watch is software. So over at Daring Fireball, John Gruber writes, Apple refuses to say so, but it seems clear that this is a software change. These new watch units still have the blood oxygen sensor, but the sensor is disabled by software. This workaround definitely does not apply to the already sold watches, even after those watches upgrade to future versions of watchOS. The reason why is that the ITC injunction is an import ban. Apple is banned from importing watches that violate Massimo's patents. Units that have already been sold aren't affected by an import ban.
Yeah, that's what we were wondering about last time. This seems like pretty solid info, even though if it's not officially confirmed by Apple. And by the way, if you go to Apple's website and you go to the Apple Watch page, you'll see a big blue banner on the top that fades to black after a few seconds that says, Apple Watch Series 9 and Ultra 2 no longer include the blood oxygen feature. I presume you won't see that banner if you're not in the US, but if you are, there it is. Boom, right at the top of the page before it fades out. Never mind. It might come back. We'll see.
All right. And then we have some information from some, I'm going to call them optometrists. Maybe they're ophthalmologists. I always get them backwards. I'm so sorry. But people, eye professionals, eye care professionals. Let's go with that. Todd Zarwell writes, as further proof that you have a listener in every profession, I'm an optometrist, there we go, who has been listening to you since the days of Hypercritical and Build and Analyze. Here's some information about the math of focal distances. If you're using metric measurements, the additional close power is just the reciprocal of the focal length in meters. If you're correct about the Vision Pro, excuse me, the Apple Vision Pro, having focal distances of 1.3 meters, and you'll need 1 over 1.3 or about 0.7 diopters of additional power or add power over your normal distance correction. So if you usually wear a negative 6D prescription for distance, you'll need about a negative 5.25D to see effort-free at 1.3 meters. If you wear a plus 2D to see far, you'll want a plus 2.75D. And if your glasses prescription includes astigmatism, this adjustment will only affect the sphere power. Of course, this is assuming you want the lenses to do all the focusing work for you. Most people under 40, womp womp, or the three of us, can do all the focusing they need to see things up close. And I'd even say many people under 50, could focus up to 1.3 meters without additional add power. But trying to sustain that focus for long periods of time could become uncomfortable. I'd be curious to learn how the folks at Apple will approach this. Will they just use the distance prescription? Will they automatically adjust it by adding 0.75? Will it be age dependent? For example, under 40 years old, no adjustment, 40 to 45 year old plus 0.25, etc. I have a hard time believing that they'd want people to get specific glasses prescriptions that are adjusted to focus at 1.3 meters, though. The easiest thing to do would be to just extrapolate from the distance prescription. Dealing with people's reading prescriptions, computer prescriptions, etc., would just introduce a lot of confusion into the process.
Yeah, this brings up one point that I saw a lot of people asking questions about. They're like, why would it be a focal distance of 1.3 meter? No one's going to have glasses that are calibrated to 1.3 meters. They're going to have their distance glasses and their reading glasses for, like, reading distances with the add power that we talked about. And I was talking about, like, where you can go to your eye doctor and just tell them what normal distance you look at. The important point that's brought out by Todd here is when you adjust prescriptions, like, if you have, regular eyes with lenses in them, even if you're an old person, you still have the ability to use the muscles in your eye to squish your eye lens into a different shape, to change your focal distance. Like, that gets worse as you get older, but it doesn't go away. So you don't need a prescription exactly suited to your eyes in a total relaxed state at 1.3 meters. That's what I say, like, accommodation, right? Like, you could get that. You could say, give me a prescription that lets me see 20/20 at 1.3 meters without me having to do anything with my eye muscles, right? But most people, you know, have some ability to change their focal distance by using their eye muscles. It just decreases how much and how far you can go. So you don't need glasses calibrated, a prescription calibrated to 1.3 meters. You can have it calibrated any distance away from that that you can accommodate by squishing your eye muscles to focus on that. And again, as you get older, that the amount that you can squish gets worse because I guess your lens gets harder or whatever, you know, because you're getting old and you're just getting crusty, right? That's why old people need two sets of glasses, because they can no longer change their focal distance as much as they could when they were young and healthy and vibrant. Yes. But anyway, so
hey, I'm still healthy and vibrant.
Yeah. As Todd points out, if it's near the edge of what you can accommodate, like you really got to use your eye muscles to really squish your hard little lens to see it, it might be uncomfortable a long period of time. So you want some prescription that's close to 1.3 meters, but don't think that you have to get a prescription that's exactly 1.3 meters. When I was a younger person, I just had one pair of glasses and I could see every distance with them. And I didn't have any ad power on my prescription. I was a young person. I had supple lenses. I would say, here's my prescription. And I can see right in front of my face and all the way down the road. And that just changes when you get older, right? So that's the important thing to remember. Your eyes do focus themselves. They have the ability to do that. Most people's eyes anyway. I think if you get like cataract surgery and they put like solid lenses in there, you might lose a lot of that ability. But anyway, so don't think you need some special prescription. And I'm also curious about what Apple's doing, because I would imagine they're just using your distance prescription. Because for most people, with your distance prescription, you can do 1.3 meters. For me, it's borderline. If I put on my distance prescription, I can focus at 1.3 meters, but it hurts my eyeballs because I'm old. So that's kind of at the limit of my... But anyway, don't think you don't have to buy glasses for every focal distance, right? Your eyes will do some work themselves. It's just a question of how old are your eyes and how much work can they do?
Then Jaycon K writes, optometrist here. You mentioned the focal distance of the Apple Vision Pro, Hi, I'm Casey. Being 1.3 meters, ad powers are written as the inverse of a meter, or 1 over 1.3, which is about plus 0.75. So people looking for a typical single vision correction at 1.3 meters would be their distance prescription plus 0.75. We typically test ad powers at 40 centimeters, making 1 over 0.4 or plus 2.5 a common reader prescription. However, this all assumes the patient has no accommodation or eyes focusing power that they are adding. Younger, thankfully, Jaycon K provided a pronunciation guide, which I will now butcher. Younger presbyopes still can accommodate or focus some, so the bifocal strength is less. I think that, John, this is what you were talking about. Interestingly, the Apple website instructs people to pick the reading insert that matches their prescription. So I'm sure that if the lenses are compensating for the difference in the Apple Vision Pro, focal length versus how it's typically measured. Either way, I'm really curious to hear more about the Vision Pro. About Apple Vision Pro insert process. It's so awkward. Why do they make us do this? As well as feedback on the visual experience. Also, it's worth noting, I didn't realize this until just earlier today when I was doing research for the episode. There are two different kinds of inserts, and I think we're going to talk more about this later, but there's reader inserts, and that's Apple's word, where you just, I guess you kind of just tell them what kind of a script you want.
It's like the kind of glasses you can buy at the drugstore.
Right.
Yeah, because readers, you don't need a prescription to buy reading glasses in the U.S. You just know, oh, I'm a plus 1.5 or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then there's the, what we have already been talking about, the like full-on scripted or prescription inserts, which is what I think Todd Zarwell was talking about, and it sounds like Jaycon K is more talking about the reader inserts. I wish I had given that context before. I apologize. But anyway, there you have it. All right, go team. Let's talk Vision Pro, baby. So the pre-orders have happened. I did notice, by the way, that the URL for the Vision Pro is not apple.com/Vision Pro, but rather apple.com/Apple-Vision-Pro, because of course it is. But nevertheless, pre-orders happened. We'll talk about what we did or did not order in a minute and whether or not we caved or you're kept up to our theories from last week. But let's go through what was available to order. There were three storage tiers. The default was 256 gigs, which came in at $3,499. Then 512 gigs, so doubling that is an additional $200 to basically $3,700. And a terabyte is plus $400, so doubling it again. So a total of $3,900, which is a lot of money. Then AppleCare Plus is $500 or maybe $499 or alternatively $25 a month. And then there's a litany of accessories that you can order. So gentlemen, please jump in and interrupt me when you're ready. We start with an extra battery that is $200. There is a travel case, a bespoke travel case, which is also $200 flipping.
It's like optioning a Porsche. Everything is at least $200.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, it's so true. It's so true.
Yeah, the travel case in particular, like, ooh, that's a lot of money for that.
It's made out of $1 bills.
Yeah, right. And annoyingly, I knew that, I think it was Spigen, whatever they're called, came out with a travel case that was something like $30 to $50. And I saw that it was a thing. And if I had ordered a Vision Pro, I should have ordered it. And so I regret not having done so. But
don't
that's
worry.
Neither
like,
here nor there.
I mean, so keep in mind also, like, you know, stuff that's not proprietary to the Vision Pro, like a case. You know, anybody can make a case very easily for this.
Or a battery, yeah. Probably.
Possibly. Well, I don't know. I think
that was discussed.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, but anyway, like, any of these things, like, you're basically paying for day one, you know, Apple nice version of this, it's always going to be a huge premium. Whereas if you just wait a few months, at most, you'll be able to buy, like, you know, a million $30 versions on Amazon of things like the travel case and stuff like that.
Yeah, I looked on Amazon to see if there was anything there.
I mean,
yet.
Look, like, I know what you got to in a second, of, like, the Belkin battery holder, which is basically a plastic bracket for the battery that's $50.
For your $200 battery.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we didn't actually put that in the show notes.
I didn't put third-party stuff in there.
Like, obviously, like, this
well,
is,
but
this
that's
is clearly,
barely
like,
third-party.
This is day one. Yeah, they work with Apple on this for sure. But you can get a Belkin piece of plastic with a belt clip for the battery for $50. Because, of course, the battery, in typical Apple design, the battery is just a smooth, featureless blob of metal. So, like, there's no, and you can tell, even in the Vision Pro travel case for $200, to hold the battery, they have to, like, strap it in. Because they designed this blob of the battery that has zero way to attach anything to it. So, so the only ways to attach it to things or to attach things to it are incredibly, you know, inelegant wraparound or, you know, straps or plastic kind of things. Like, they couldn't have just put, like, you know, a mounting hole or a slot, or it's just like the AirTag. It's like
a naked robotic core. Oh my God. Add what you want to it, but we're not going to tell you need a clip. What if you just want a slippery little stone? You can't
Moving
make
along.
It smaller, but you can always make it bigger. Buy this $50 case.
All right. So then light seals are $200 a piece.
So now let's look at this here. We have a piece of electronics, the battery. We have a piece of cloth, the case, and we have a cushiony thing. All of these things are $200? Really? These are equally valuable, equally just
the light
everything.
Seal, that seems especially egregious because it's like
it's
really
a wear part. Yeah.
It is, well, not, I mean, the thing on the front.
It's,
that
not,
actually,
it's not the cushion, you're right.
Yeah, the cushion is what touches your face.
Oh, and if you're thinking, by the way, oh, light seal, that's a thing that goes in your face. No, it's an extra $30 to get a complete thing that goes in your face.
Oh, because the light seal doesn't include the cushion?
I don't think so. I think it's $200 for the light seal and then $30
for the
light seal cushion.
It says it includes the cushions in two sizes.
All right, anyway, replacement cushions are $30.
Yeah, but if for instance you need to change the size of the light seal, like if you're adding another person to it or giving it to someone else or selling it to someone else, they probably have to spend $200 for a different light seal.
Yeah, it's bananas.
And what is this made of? It's like, you know, probably some kind of, like, you know, rigid, you know, plastic frame with cloth.
It's 80% recycled material, so
I mean,
it looks real nice.
For what it's worth, I don't really begrudge Apple for this being not cheap, but this is quite expensive. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what to make of it. But anyway, so the light seal, which, by the way, a friend of the show, Quinn Nelson, pointed out to me, somebody, M1 Astra on Twitter, pointed out there appear to be, according to this individual, 28 light seal sizes. My word.
That's why they don't list them. I put the sizes here, but when you look at the light seal when you're trying to buy it, it says what size is available. They're going to make you measure your face with their scanner thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You don't get to pick from a pop-up menu of 28 sizes. You use, and what it gives you is like a number and a letter. Like, you know, we'll talk about it with the ordering processes later, but like, it just tells you the size. And presumably when you go to the store, they'll do the same thing. Scan your face with the Face ID scanner, and then it comes up with the size. And obviously, if you're at the store, you could probably try it on if you're doing a tryout thing and decide it doesn't feel right or whatever. But yeah, a lot of sizes.
Indeed. And then the light seal cushion, as discussed, is $29.30. Sizes N, N plus, W, and W plus. I guess normal and wide?
Narrow and wide. Not normal. Oh, it's narrow. Not normative. It's narrow.
Well, I couldn't think of a better N word, but no. Narrow. Narrow, sorry. And wide. There we go. Oh, my word. We'll cut all that out in post. Don't worry.
Yes, we will.
Then we have the Solo Knit Band. So this is the one that goes behind your head, if I'm not mistaken.
This is the one that looks like it's the one Apple wanted to make.
Yeah, right. It's the one that looks cool. It looks less, you know, cumbersome.
less slapped together in the last minute.
Right. So that's $100, which honestly, that seems more in line with what I would expect, because that appears to be a relatively complex thing to make.
It's an inert piece of fabric with adjustable straps.
It has a knob on the side.
It has a knob.
All
and,
right, sure. Okay.
And it does seem complicated to construct. But yeah, $100 in sizes small, medium, or large. Then there's the dual loop band. Now, this one, to your point, John, does look like they threw it together at the last minute. That's also $100.
It's got
also
twice as many loops, and it's the same price. What a bargain.
It's also small, medium, and large. Then the optical inserts for reader style are $100. Optical inserts full-on prescription style are $150. And both of those are for pairs. So $100 for a pair, $150 for a pair.
And just to be clear, when you buy the Vision Pro, you get a battery, you get a light seal with a cushion, you get the solo band and the dual loop band. You don't get the optical inserts of any kind. So it's not like you have to add all these numbers that you put up together. You pick your storage size, which who knows how anybody knows what storage size to pick, because we don't really know what we're going to be storing on it. And then if you want a travel case, you can add that on. And if you need optical inserts, you can add them on. But everything else comes in the box with it. So it does have a lot of stuff. Like I said, it does come with both the straps, which is nice. You don't have to pick one of them.
Yes, yeah. At these prices, it comes with $600 of accessories in the box.
Yeah, well.
Oh, my gosh, you're not kidding,
one.
Are you? Holy
no, I'm
smokes.
Not.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, so Marco, what'd you order?
I got the base model. And exactly like as base model as it can be. I didn't,
what?
I didn't get any glasses. I didn't get any extra storage. And, you know, it comes with
Do
all.
Do you not need glasses with it?
I don't think so. So, you know, if we're correct that we're roughly doing like a, you know, 1.3 meter focus distance here, I don't need the only glasses I need are reading glasses for up close stuff. And my minimum focus distance is still less than my arm length, which my arm is not 1.3 meters long. So I think I'm fine. I don't think I'm going to need any kind of reader insert, but just, if for some reason I do, I can always just get those afterwards.
Yeah. Well, you heard it here first. Marco bought the base model.
I know. I am
on purpose for himself.
No,
I am for other people.
So I'll tell you why. So, okay, first of all, I didn't get AppleCare because it's $500, and I don't see myself taking the Vision Pro many places. And I think by the time I am using the platform that much, if that time ever comes, there will probably be another model out that I will probably want to upgrade to. Because I think this is, again, I think it's going to be a fairly slow build up in like the app ecosystem and stuff like that. So I didn't necessarily think AppleCare was worth it for $500. Also, I'm pretty careful with my stuff most of the time, so I don't see myself breaking it. Anyway, and then on the storage tiers, I got the 256 base model because I'm considering this basically like an iPad. And I think, like, how do I use iPads? And I'm not going to, like, I don't foresee myself loading it up with a whole bunch of stuff to take on a plane that would actually exceed that level. And if it's anything other than, like, loading it up with media, I don't know what I would use that much space for, you know? It's like, so I didn't want to, like, super option up this one and then have all these resources I never used. And then when I want to buy the next one that's even better in 2 years, to have invested so much in this one for stuff I never used.
Oh, I don't think you should be like ashamed or kicking yourself or whatever.
It's
about
just out of
getting
character.
It's just extremely out of character.
I mean,
I'm very proud of you.
Well, I mean, and you know, when I buy iPads and stuff, I don't ramp up the storage.
Yeah,
that
yeah
much.
But that's, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you like you said, you know how you're going to use an iPad. It's a known quantity. I think that's the problem with the storage in this one. Nobody knows, like, is storage going to be important, or is it going to be like the Apple TV where it's mostly a non-issue? We don't know. We don't know what the app ecosystem is going to look like. And so everyone, especially when you see these prices, you're like, let me just get the base one. Like, because like you said, Marco, if it turns out that you're wrong, you're like, oh, I shouldn't have got that one. It's constantly being filled up. By the time you're annoyed by it, you're just going to get the next model anyway. So it doesn't
yeah.
matter.
And I mean, and to be fair, like, I do expect media for this is going to be large. So, like, you know, if they had a 128, I wouldn't have gotten that one. You know,
but, yeah, like a 3D movie, because it's got to have basically a separate movie for each eye.
Yeah, so like, or even you know, what I expect to enjoy on this a lot is like immersive experiences. You know, put me on a mountaintop or whatever. That I expect to enjoy a lot. But I mean, how many of those am I going to have on there at once? Like, how big can they possibly be? You know, I think 200 gigs of free space should be plenty for what will, for my purposes, mostly be a dev kit and a messing around occasionally kind of device.
Well, we still have like questions like, but what if you turn on iMessage in the cloud? Oh, all your storage is gone now. But that's don't be no problem, because iMessage gives you lots of ways to control how much space it takes up your devices. So don't worry, it'll be fine. No, all right, it doesn't. Focus. It just takes all your space and there's nothing you can do.
Focus. All right. So for me, I also ordered the base model. I did not get any accessories. I did not get Apple Care, although I'm thinking I might actually add Apple Care because I saw.
We'll get to the repair prices.
Yeah, I saw the repair prices, which we'll get to. But suffice to say, I think I might add Apple Care. And the part of the reason I think I might add Apple Care is, if you'll permit me a slight tangent, I'd like to tell a funny story. So I was at a friend's house. It was a total of four couples, inclusive of Aaron and myself and you know, the associated children. We were hanging out at somebody's house. This was, I think, the day of pre-order, the day after, something like that. I forget exactly when it was. But we're all hanging out, and they're all just beating me up in a friendly way about, you know, spending this pile of money on this thing that I may or may not even want. And that was totally justified, for the record. But nevertheless, it was clear pretty quickly in the conversation that as much as they're giving me a hard time about it, everyone in the group was at least intrigued by this thing. And I started to explain, well, here's the thing, though. I don't know if you could try mine. Like, I'm happy to have you try it, but it may not be a particularly great experience because your faces may be differently shaped than mine. Well, they are differently shaped than mine. And, you know, the light seal may not match. So then that got into a conversation about what the hell does that mean? What are you talking about? Blah, blah, blah. Well, how do we figure out if what you got works for us? Well, come to think of it, why don't you all bust out your iPhones and go and pretend like you're buying a Vision Pro? And so the next thing you know, and I wish I had taken a picture. I didn't have the presence of mind to take a picture. But the next thing you know, our video would have been even better. All of them are looking at their phones doing the, and I know this is not a video podcast, but doing the thing for scanning your face, like Face ID style, in order to get their size. And so everyone was checking out pretty much at the same time, checking out what size light shield they would need so they could see whether or not they could have a good experience testing out my Vision Pro. And the answer was, of a total of eight people, inclusive again of Aaron and myself, they were all boy-girl couples, as it turns out, all but two of the women could use my, or were sized to be the same as me, even though these body types are wildly different among the people that are allegedly the same size as me. The body types are wildly different, which I thought was quite funny. But yeah, just imagine a total of eight adults, you know, all of us, pretty much all of us in our early 40s, just doing the thing all at once, trying to size ourselves. Maybe it was one of those experiences you had to be there, but it was hilarious to be watching all this go down. But yeah, I bring all this up to say, and this is relevant for the Apple Care Plus thing, because even though all of them are probably better with their stuff than I am, I just have a vision of, like, I have a vision ding of handing, you know, handing the Vision Pro from one person to the other and it dropping on some tile or something like that. And holy monkey, let's just skip forward to the repair costs.
Hey, but don't you want to know if I ordered one?
John, did you order a Vision Pro?
No.
Did anyone in your family order one?
No, but I did go through the order process to get my size. You should have just told the people, oh, don't worry, if you want to try mine out, just buy a new light seal for $200. Just $200 to try Casey's headset.
Right, right. And then I would have a collection of them at the end. For the record, not that it matters, solo knit band small, do loop band small, light seal 21W. I don't know if that matters, but that's what
I got. Someone was saying that they were getting different size measurements whether or not they said they had prescription lenses, but they could have just been variability in the face.
No, I had read a lot of that, and my understanding, which I am not sure this is correct. Excuse me, let me try that again. Hi, Future yep. Marco. I actually heard that a lot as well. In my understanding, which I am not sure is correct, is that it actually accounts for a little bit of depth for the inserts if you're getting inserts. Again, I don't know if that's true. I could be accidentally lying to you, but it does stand to reason that maybe that's true. I don't know. Just a theory.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, obviously I didn't order one, but if I had I ordered one, like it would just make me feel a lot more comfortable to be able to sort of try on to know.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, especially since we don't know what like the return exchange situation will be like. Because of the variability, because it's just your phone scanning your face, because some people have reported, I guess if you're on a borderline between two different sizes, depending on what mood it's in and when you scan your face, if it's going to put you on one side or the other, it's like trying on jeans. I mean, you can know your jean size, but it really helps to try them on first.
Right. Yeah, I'm very curious. And I think, Marco, you had told me privately you're doing some in-store pickup somewhere. Is that correct?
Yeah, because I basically figured, first of all, you know, it's easier with my weird shipping situation, but also I figured if for some reason the light seal doesn't fit right or whatever, yep. I figure that's a lot easier, and they might even, you know, depending on what the process is for in-store pickup, they might even have me take it out and try it on there before I go.
Yep.
So that I figure in person is probably best for something like this.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way in that, and partially because my delivery schedule for UPS and FedEx seems to be at the end of the day, and partially because it just seemed like a smarter approach. I am also doing in-store pickup, and so by the time I got through the ordering process, which we should briefly talk about actually, but I went through the ordering process as quick as I could. I was trying to toggle between, or I was alternating between my iPad, my iPhone, and my Mac, and it so happened that the iPhone landed first, and that was excellent because that seemed to be the thing that was most equipped to scan my face and so on and so forth. It took a little while to scan my face, I think in part because I was in a relatively dark room in the house. I was in the office and it was, you know, still dark outside, or maybe it was an overcast day.
And you may be hearing this and say, but Casey, Face ID doesn't need light. It just uses infrared. What difference does it make what the lighting was? Well, I can tell you that the scanning that you do in the Apple Store app on your phone demands that your room is well lit. I don't know why it does, mm-hmm. but I just tell you for a fact, it will tell you that your room is too dark. And Face ID will never tell you that, because Face ID, I believe, does not use the plain old light camera. It uses the IR spreader entirely. So whatever they're doing for this thing, apparently it also wants to actually see your face. You need to be well lit.
It threw me off, too, because this one made me do just up, down, left, right, not a big circle. So I kept doing it wrong, and it kept yelling at me.
Same. Yeah. Exactly the same story.
You trained us for years to do the roll your head around to loosen up your neck muscles, and now you got to go up, down, left, right. All right.
Yep, I screwed up. Particularly, I think they have you scan it twice, and I think it was the second time. I don't know why I did it right the first time and not the second, but I screwed up the second time because I was doing the roll, just as you were saying, Marco. And that is an important point, John. I appreciate you jumping in there. Yeah, I definitely got yelled at once or twice that the room wasn't bright enough. But nonetheless, it was really easy for me, other than my own issues following directions and doing up, down, left, right, or not doing up, down, left, right, and rather doing a circle. It was pretty easy. I mean, I didn't get the 8 o'clock time slot, which is a little bit of a bummer, but I'm a big boy. I can wait 30 freaking minutes. And so, yeah, I'm 5 stars on the ordering process. I thought it was really, really straightforward. I heard a lot of people had problems, particularly in busier stores, where they would go to, you know, pick a pickup slot, appointment, whatever. And then during the time they're doing the financial portion of the checkout, then the pickup slot would run out of like available spots. And I guess it was presented as a payment error, but really the issue was that the pickup slot had been snatched out from under them. And this is huge Apple energy to show either no error or an incorrect error when there's something wrong. But I didn't have that problem. Like, it was lickety split for me. But I did hear a lot of reports of that. But I don't know of anyone that I had seen that was deeply interested in getting one, that in plan to get one, that wasn't getting one either day one or, you know, within the first week or something like that. And, you know, friend of the show, Alex Cox, they ended up ordering one late on launch day, if I'm not mistaken, and still was able to find a day one delivery. I don't think it was first thing in the morning, but, you know, still a day one delivery, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, we'll get to the rumored sales numbers in a little bit, but I hoisted up the repair costs.
Yes, thank you. I got myself sidetracked. So, yeah. So, as I was saying, you know, as all of my friends are scanning their faces and we look like a bunch of dorks, nevertheless, it occurred to me I will be potentially passing this backward and forward, and I think I will probably go on at least a couple of trips with this thing. And at first, I thought there's no way I want to pay $500 for AppleCare, and then I saw the repair prices. Cracked cover glass, $800. With AppleCare Plus, the extraordinarily affordable $300. The full replacement.
It doesn't even save you the entire price?
Of course it doesn't.
You're paying $500 for this AppleCare Plus to save you a few hundred dollars?
Well, wait for the next repair, though.
No, it's to save $500 because it's $299 Oh, no, I'm sorry. I misdid that math. So I'll cut all that out to you, future Mark. All that back.
We can't do math. It's fine.
Yeah, it's all right. And then additionally, what we assume to be a full replacement due to, quote, other damage, $2,400 if you do not have AppleCare. $2,400 if you do not have AppleCare. But it is comparatively genuinely affordable at $300 if you do.
Oh, my God.
So for me, I think as long as they let me retroactively, you know how they typically in the first month or so let you add AppleCare.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm probably going to be adding AppleCare because holy jamones.
So here's the thing. If you crack the cover glass, wouldn't you just leave it cracked? Who cares if people can see your eyes? As long as everything else works fine, I think people are going to be like, yeah, I'll pass on the $300 with AppleCare glass replacement so people can see my computerized eyeballs.
but what if it affects the cameras and stuff? That's the question.
So here's the thing. Like the two categories, we'll put a link in the show notes to the webpage. The only two things you can pick are cracked cover glass and other damage. And other damage just covers everything. What I'm wondering is like, okay, but what if there's no damage? What if just like something goes wonky, like your R1 chip fries itself or something? Is that also a $300 repair? Is any kind of thing $300?
Well, that would
AppleCare?
Be warranty for you know the first
for the
year.
First year, yeah. But after that, anyway.
Oh, man.
So I don't know. I don't know how to gauge the AppleCare on this. I remember when I noticed that the AppleCare had run out on my 2019 Mac Pro, which happened several years ago at this point, and I was like. Because if anything breaks on this thing, it's also like a bazillion dollars. So, yeah, I mean, I guess this argues for doing the $25 a month thing instead, so you can just continue it indefinitely. But for this particular product, if you make it for the first 2 years, you're probably buying a newer, better one.
Yeah, because I can't imagine, like, you know, if you get really into this, 2 years from now, there's going to be a better one that you're going to want.
And you're going to want it, yeah.
Yeah. David Schaub in the chat makes a good point. They only have one part other than a full hardware replacement, so that's probably why, at least for now, it's cover glass or anything else.
It's just like the Apple Watch.
Yeah, no, it's
they
truly,
didn't replace
yeah.
the cover glass on that. It's just total replacement.
Yeah. All right, the weight. So let's talk about weight. This is in grams. All right. So I'm going to start with other things and end with the Vision Pro. PlayStation VR 2, 560. Valve Index, 810. Ooh. MetaQuest. Sorry, was one of you trying to jump in?
No, I was just saying, okay, wow, sorry. That's a lot.
MetaQuest 2, 503 grams. MetaQuest 3, 515 grams. MetaQuest Pro, which is the closest, I think, most analogous device to the Vision Pro, 722 grams. The Apple Vision Pro, I'm sorry, not the Apple Vision Pro, Apple Vision Pro, 600 to 650 grams, depending on the light seal and the headband. But John, you helpfully reminded us of something. Can you tell me about why these numbers aren't really fair?
So some of these, in fact, other than the Valve Index, all these headsets have their batteries built in, whereas that Apple Vision Pro weight is just the weight of the Apple Vision Pro, not including the weight of the battery. And I think that's fair, because the point is that Apple didn't put the battery on the headset. You put it in your pocket or wherever else you're going
to
put
it
with that $50
clip.
And so the weight actually isn't in the headset. But you can see it's pretty heavy. You know, the MetaQuest 2 and 3 are lighter, and they have the batteries with them. So the MetaQuest 2 and 3 are 515, and the Apple Vision Pro is 600 to 650. And those Quest ones have the battery in the headset. The Valve Index is the big chunker, but it is also probably the beefiest sort of gaming thing and includes the battery inside it. Anyway, I don't think it's outrageous. I think the weight is reasonable. I think Apple did a pretty good job keeping it light. I think Apple made a wise choice not to have the battery as part of the headset. I just wish they had made the dangling battery a little bit bigger.
Yeah, this doesn't seem that bad. I mean, like my big favorite headphones are 500 grams. So
I mean,
this seems like pretty normal for like high-end thing you'll have on your head. I mean, how much are the AirPods Max?
I was just trying to look that up, actually. It's funny you say that. It's going to take me a second to get there, but probably a lot would be my guess.
Yeah, well, they're not clamped to the
seems
front
like
of your
it's
face,
it's
though, so.
385 gram, maybe something like that.
I'm trying to look. We're stalling for time. Hi, future Marco. 384.8. Let me give you a clean edit.
Yeah.
384.8 grams. You are pretty darn close.
There you go. Yeah. So it's, I mean, they feel really heavy on your ears for a long time. But again, that's part of their design. But anyway, yeah.
Actually, 384.8 plus 134 for that ridiculous case. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So anyway, based on this, the Vision Pro Apple Vision Pro doesn't really seem like it is, you know, particularly heavy compared to its peers.
Yeah. And then apparently attaching the Zeiss optical inserts to the Apple Vision Pro. There I go again. To Apple Vision Pro requires.
They're not the boss of you, Casey. You can say it however you want. They're not going
to. No, I'm trying to make a point. This is my.
You're making a point by obeying their marketing.
I'm making a point that it's so ridiculous that this is the way they want it pronounced when nobody actually pronounced it this way except marketing at Apple. All right, it doesn't matter. Attaching Zeiss optical inserts to Apple Vision Pro requires pairing. On 9to5 Mac, they write, the pair of Zeiss optical inserts comes with a, quote, personal code, quote, to pair the lenses to Apple Vision Pro. After attaching the optical inserts magnetically to the headset, users will have to, quote, scan the pairing code on the card inside Zeiss optical inserts box to finalize the pairing process, quote. The code in question appears to be an app clip code that triggers a system action to pair the Zeiss lenses to the Apple Vision Pro. That's interesting and kind of cool.
Why do you think this brings up a point
that was mentioned before, right? You may be wondering, and I don't know if this is different in other countries, why can you get readers, like we were saying, in the drugstore? Like, you don't need a prescription, you just go buy them. Whereas Apple is insisting that you have a prescription signed by a U.S. Qualified optometrist or whatever to be able to even buy these inserts. Like, why all of the stricture around certain kinds of vision correction and not others? I don't actually know the answer. An optometrist will write in maybe in next episode and tell us. Here's my best guess. My best guess is, based on what we were just talking about, like accommodation and everything, that if you put on a pair of readers and you pick the wrong one, you pick plus 2.5 instead of plus one or whatever, that it doesn't cause as much eye strain. Like, you're not going to mess up your eyes by doing it. It'll just kind of, like, things will be blurry and things close up will be bigger than they were or whatever. Whereas the prescription lenses that you need a prescription for, like these inserts for people who can't just use readers, if you were to get the wrong prescription and wear them for a long time, that it could, if not mess with your eyes, then at least cause problems with your eyes in terms of like causing eye strain and potentially, I suppose, mess with your eyes. I've seen a couple of stories recently about what causes nearsightedness, what causes people not to be able to see things far away. It was part of a scare story of like, oh, kids, they're staring at their phone screens up close. And if you do a lot of that, it will make you nearsighted. Kind of like the thing that your parents used to tell you, if your nose is buried in books, you'll end up wearing glasses because you're focused on things up close. And it turns out there is some medically explainable mechanism within how the eye forms and grows over time that lends some support to the idea that if you spend a lot of time focusing on things really close, that your eyes can become misshapen in a way that makes you not able to see things far away. That's my guess. If you're an optometrist and you're out there and you know why is it just some, you know, historical regulatory thing that doesn't make any sense? Or is there actually a medical reason not to let people say, I know by a prescription, it's this, that, and that. Give me these lenses. Is that why we're not allowed to do that in this country? Or is it just some weird thing? And anyway, this pairing process, you only need to pair, I think, the ones that, well, we'll see when people get these. I would imagine you don't need to pair the readers for the same reason that you don't need a prescription to buy the readers. But we'll see how that works out. If you do need to pair the readers, then I don't understand this feature at all. You can even get these engraved, by the way, because it's hard to tell, like, one insert from one person insert from another. They, like, magnetically snap in. But I think you get free engraving on them, or you can put your name on the insert. So if you have a whole family using the Vision Pro and they have different inserts and presumably different $200 face shields, that's how you can do it. Just look for the tiny, incredibly low contrast engraving that you won't be able to see without your actual reading glasses, and then you'll know which inserts to put in.
Wonderful. All right. We made a brief mention of this earlier in the episode. Mark Gurman writes, I've been told that Apple's initial inventory for launch weekend is about 80,000 units, which the company sold out in the first hour of pre-orders. And is that true, though? I don't think that's actually true.
Read the next rumor. These are all people guessing about how many units they have. Gurman is usually pretty well sourced, but, mm-hmm. You know.
So then Ming-Chi Kuo writes, Apple sold between 160,000 and 180,000 Vision Pro headsets during its first pre-order weekend, according to Apple analyst Ming-Chi Kuo. I'm sorry, this is being recounted by Mac Rumors. Kuo said that the headset sold out soon after the pre-order process opened, with shipping times for all models slipping by 5 to 7 weeks. While the instant sellout and extended shipping times appear to be positive at first glance, Kuo cautioned that shipping dates remain unchanged 48 hours after pre-orders opened, indicating that demand may quickly be tapering off after core enthusiasts place their orders. Again, it's hard for me to square this, which I'm not trying to say that they're wrong, but square this with what Alex had, where they were able to order, I think it was like my evening time, and still get a day one delivery. Now, maybe
they're saying for the first weekend. The first weekend is 2 days, right?
Fair. Yeah.
It's not like on the very first day. Like, I didn't check, but if you were to go to order now, I'm assuming you can't get day one delivery anymore.
Yeah, I didn't check either. But
I mean, the thing we all don't know, and we're trusting rumors like Gurman or whoever to tell us, is like, we don't know how many have been made and are ready to ship to people. And, you know, I presumably only Apple knows that.
Well, so I haven't confirmed this, but Chris 3 in the chat writes, I just went on and could get one for the 3rd of February in store, but late February if shipped.
Yeah, so that's the other factor. Very often with everything that Apple sells, if you try to get it shipped to your house, you get one shipping date. But if you're willing to go to a store and pick it up, you get a different one, because I guess there's different pools of inventory for retail stores. Like, they always want to have stuff available in retail stores at the expense of people who are ordering it for delivery.
Yep. Anyway, so we'll see what happens. And then, of course, we have to bring up the reseller market. And there's a post on 9to5Mac which talks about this. And apparently, based on both what 9to5Mac has found and what we looked at briefly, it looks like generally it's between $5,000 and $10,000. Yes, I said $10,000 for one of these. I did try to look for completed auctions on eBay, and I think I did find one for something like $5,000. So that's the thing.
Yeah, it's some story. I wish I had the link for notes of saying, like, you know, that's people who wanted to resell this basically had found a way to automate the process that we all just described of, like, going through the Apple Store app and scanning your face and buying one. Apparently they found a way to automate that. I don't know. I'm just picturing, like, mannequin heads or something or whatever. So they could order tons of them for resale. That was the story. I don't know if the story is true. I don't remember where I saw it, but I just imagine, you know, the motivation to get a bunch of these on day one so you can resell them, kind of like ticket scalpers, is motivating somebody to come up with a way to quickly and in an automated fashion go through the face scanning process.
Yeah. And then a couple of videos that are, I genuinely think are worth your time. First of all, there's the Apple Vision Pro guided tour, which you can find on Apple's website. There's different segments, but they stitch them together into one cohesive movie that's something like 10 minutes. And I think it's a pretty good representation of what the Vision Pro is all about. And they do briefly talk about using your Mac within the context of Vision OS. I wish I had a better, shorter description for that. But anyways, they show that among many other things. The one funny thing about this, though, and I'm not the first to point this out, is that they have someone who they claim had never used a Vision Pro, which I do take on face value that that's probably true. But the gentleman that's using the Vision Pro, they have a persona, or they have the eyesight turned on. And well,
they set it up off camera.
Right, that exactly. So they must have at least done enough setup to get through the orientation process and eyesight scanning process off camera.
That was a really weird, like, I have a hard time believing that those were his first reactions.
They're actors. Yeah. Don't tell anybody.
Yeah, well, like, still.
And they were so, the reactions were so well in line with how marketing wants to describe things, and everything was so.
They're reading from a script. Don't tell anybody. Like,
there is no way.
It's a commercial.
Yeah.
Still,
I thought it was tastefully done. I thought it was nice.
It was good.
We all want to believe that we will be happy in our beautiful clutter-free home, led through a magical experience of this Apple product by attractive, charismatic people.
That's the thing. Exactly. The content of it was good. Just like that, the conceit that, oh, this is allegedly this person's first time ever. I don't really buy that.
I thought it was fine. I mean, the important job, the reason I think that it's worth looking at is, if you're wondering, if you just want to see for the umpteenth time or you've never seen it before, what are all the things you can do with this? They go through all of them. Here you go. This is what it looks like. You can do this. You can use an app. You can look at a movie. They just go through it all very quickly. And it's a nice overview. It's a guided tour. Yep. I thought it was a well-done video. If for example, like Casey, if you're having dinner over someone and they're like, what is this thing you're talking about? I would send them the link to the video and say, if you actually want to see what this thing is that we're talking about, this video will more or less explain it. You know, as long as you get the idea that what you're seeing very often is what that person is seeing inside the headset, you'll be fine.
Yeah. They also have a like minute and a half long making Apple Vision Pro video, which is very much, you know, marketing. It's almost like, you know, it's the sort of thing that usually accompanied Johnny in his white room. But it was a seriously sweet 90-second video, so it's worth your time. It's bananas, the stuff that they're going through in order to make these things. So
it's trying to make you feel better about the price. You're like, well, it is really complicated to build, and we have a lot of fancy machines. Although I always wonder with these things, like, how to square the beauty of these videos and the machines making it with what must surely be the much more cluttered and sad looking factories where things are put together with workers being oppressed by, you know, like, it's just, there's, there's the marketing video of the factory, and there's what a real factory looks like and how the people who work in that factory feel about working there. And that's, I think there's still some distance between those.
Yeah.
By the way, some quick real-time follow-up. I also just now checked the Vision Pro ordering to see like how back-ordered is it now. And so now we are almost a week from ordering being opened up. I'm able to get all three capacities at not at like any store I want, but at a store that's you know within a decent drive for day two or three delivery, like February 4th, February 5th, February 4th. Like it's all like you know really right there. So maybe there's some and they're all back ordered, but you know for mail order out to like February 28th. But that's very surprising to me. I think maybe. Obviously, you know, they're going to probably reserve a lot for retail, but maybe these are not actually selling out as
quickly.
Well,
again, we don't know how many they made. If they already made as many as they can make, like they made all of them now and they're just sitting there waiting, then, yeah, you're not going to sell through a year's supply in the first week. But if they made, 20,000 of them, they still have some left, that's much more concerning. But, yeah, only Apple knows.
Yeah.
I also wonder if they favored, and I think, Marco, you were just alluding to this, if they favored the retail experience. And I wonder if they have... you know, like regional caches of Vision Pros or something like that, which they can easily get to a retail store, but maybe is a little bit harder to get into the shipping ecosystem for whatever reason. I know nothing about logistics. Maybe that's an extremely,
some people were speculating that the Apple might be making decisions about what other countries to open up based on how much stuff they have lying around, like for Canada or whatever, you know, so we'll see.
Speaking of other countries, that was a perfect segue. Thank you, John. Apple Vision Pro, App Store, Apple Music, and TV app require U.S. Apple IDs. So this was stated on Apple's website in the pre-order section, but Mac Rumors has a pretty good summary. For international customers who are thinking of purchasing Apple Vision Pro in the United States and using it in their own country, Apple has cautioned that they will be faced with several limitations when attempting to use the device. According to an FAQ on Apple's Vision Pro pre-order page, first of all, the Apple Vision Pro only supports English US for language and typing and English for Siri and dictation. Number two, the App Store requires an Apple ID with region set to the US. Number three, purchases on Apple Music and the TV app require an Apple ID with region set to the US. Number four, for customers with vision correction needs, Zeiss will only accept vision prescriptions written by U.S. eye care professionals and will only ship to U.S. locations. Number five, customers may not be able to access certain apps, features, or content due to licensing or other restrictions in those countries or regions. And finally, number six, Apple support is only available in the U.S. This is fascinating. This is particularly fascinating for a lot of our mutual friends. I don't recall where I heard the story, probably on Connected or maybe App Stories, but the length to which Federico and Mike have gone to procure these devices is astonishing, and it is worth listening to their stories. Again, I would look at Connected. I probably won't put a link in the show notes because I'm not sure where I heard this for sure. But anyways, it is worth investigating this because it is both funny and amazing what they've done in order to make this work. But yeah, it is kind of crummy for those not in America. And I get, especially if they're inventory constrained, why they would start here. But I do feel for our, you know, European and UK friends.
Also, I'd be terrified to change the region on anything having to do with my Apple ID because of all the horror stories I've heard about it.
You don't want to do that.
You're basically just going to end up using a test Apple ID, which is great because, again, if you used your own Apple ID and you synced your messages, it would just fill the SSD. I don't know that that's true, but I'm just bashing on Apple's poor control of storage on the iPhone when it comes to messages.
Indeed. Hello, future Marco. Hey. I personally think we should go to Ask ATP at this point.
Yeah.
All right, just
yeah,
wanted to
it.
Make sure. All right, let me scroll to the right spot. I really don't like where we have Ask ATP in our private show notes, but I have no suggestions for
it's
where
gotta,
to put
it's
it
It's
got to
be there for the reason it's there, because the
know,
other part goes
the
on forever.
Yep, I know. All right, let's do some Ask ATP. I think we've actually slacked on this accidentally for the last couple of weeks. So one way or another, we're getting back to it, baby. Nigel Warren writes, listening to the, quote, Vision Pro tidbits segment of episode 570, I was struck by how the lens inserts complicate things in a variety of ways. Do you know why the Vision Pro doesn't have some kind of focal adjustment diopter like a camera viewfinder would use? Sure seems like it would make the buying, using, sharing of the device easier. Are there specific requirements or constraints that make it not practical for a headset? Do other headsets use lens inserts or have some kind of built-in adjustment system? I thought a lot of other headsets, or at least the MetaQuest, I thought they do take inserts, but I am talking way outside my comfort zone. Do one of you actually have facts to share about this?
Well, I mean, I think this ties into everything we just discussed. All right, so what I was speculating about is there something about prescription lenses that makes that, that requires that justifies us having to have a prescription in this country to get them, unlike readers, right? In other words, some kind of health damage or thing that could be done that will be bad for your eyes if you're just allowed to do it willy-nilly. You really need someone to give you a prescription. If that's true, then maybe they don't want to provide the type of adjustment. But setting all of that aside, the much easier explanation is any kind of adjustability for lens stuff it adds space and complexity. Maybe not a lot, but it is additional space and additional complexity versus snap-in inserts. And I can imagine the snap-in inserts can be higher quality because it is just one lens element that doesn't move, that's exactly the right position, that is exactly your prescription. And then finally, there's more to your prescription than can be adjusted easily. Now, obviously, you can adjust it. When you go to the eye doctor, you know that big thing you sit in front of and they go one or two, three or four, and it's got a million different lenses that go in front of your eyes? That can adjust for everything. That's the, it's the doctor's, you know, it's their device for figuring out what your prescription is. But there's more than just that, you know, the sphere number or whatever. You can have astigmatism. They make you look at the lines, tell you which one is thicker. Like, it is possible to do all those things. But when I look at the size of the thing at the eye doctor, I think to do that well probably requires space they don't want to spend on the inside of this device. Space, weight, complexity, cost, all of that. That those, I think, are the main reasons that this doesn't exist in the Apple Vision Pro, because it makes for a smaller, lighter, simpler headset not to do that. And especially if you wanted to do it well. I don't know the details of what's going on inside that big thing in the doctor's office, aside from things tumbling in front of my eyes and things looking different. But I know it's not as simple, especially, again, if you have astigmatism, of just having a lens that you move farther and, you know, closer and farther away from your eye. If you have bad enough eyes, there's all sorts of things that can be wrong with them that are not solved by taking a single lens element and moving it farther or closer to your eye.
Lawrence Kotef writes, do you have an email backup regime outside of Time Machine or local computer backups? Recently, a family member accidentally deleted all of their iCloud and email in the Mac Mail app, not realizing that they had all the folders selected when they hit the delete button. And being a very fastidious email user, they immediately emptied the trash folder without noticing. Apple does not provide any way to restore trashed email, so we were left with restoring the mail database from a Backblaze backup. This got most of them back, but apparently Apple Mail does not always download and store the contents of emails and attachments, so many of them were blank and lost. I haven't found an obvious solution for automatically backing up an email account, and I wanted to know if this is something you have considered before. For me, it is not. I don't have a good answer. It's just I'm not terribly worried that I will put myself in that position, I say, as I knock on wood. But I don't have any good answer for this. Marco, do you do anything about this?
Not besides just local file backups. I mean, first of all, I am not an aggressive trash emptier. Like, the purpose of the trash is to be like a buffer so that you're not constantly, like, if every single time you delete anything, you immediately empty its trash. Whether it's in your mail app or the trash on your Mac, you're kind of ruining the point of the trash. So
I think of that every time I delete something from my media volume on my Synology, because the Finder says, just so you know, I'm going to delete this immediately and not move it to the trash. Is that okay? And the only choice you have is yes, it's okay, or no, don't bother deleting it.
Yeah, like, so I think getting out of the habit of trashing everything or emptying the trash constantly, like, that would be extremely beneficial for, you know, to whatever degree you have control over it, for, you know, whatever people you're talking about here. So I don't have this problem because I let the trash be the trash. I let it be a temporary buffer for deleted stuff in case I need to go get something out of it that I accidentally threw away or decided I didn't want to throw away. And I only empty the trash if I'm running low on space.
I find it funny that both of my children, and both in real life and on their computers, never empty the trash. Like on my son's laptop.
Unless you are out of space, you need the space right now, there's not much reason to empty it right after you've been
leaving. There's a reason. There's a reason, the same reason that this person's relative emptied the trash. That reason is very simple. A full trash icon bothers people. That's what it is. It's like notification badges, right? I wish there was a way in the Finder to say, don't show the crumpled up paper, because it makes people want to empty. It makes me want to empty the trash.
Yep, that's a fair point. John, do you have any backup strategies for this?
What do you think?
I'm sure you do.
Of course I do.
How many is the question?
Yeah.
Right.
So this
right.
is, here's the things I do with my email. All right. first strategy. So I use Gmail for everything. I use the Gmail web client. I use it and like it, right? But I also use Apple Mail for this one purpose, which is to pop, to use the pop protocol to pull my Gmail using pop down to my Mac. Because that way I know I've got a copy. It's not like IMAP where it might be somewhere else. And, you know, the problem they were having, it's like, oh, but Mail didn't have all the mail locally. Some of it was still on the server. I use pop, which is an older, dumber protocol, which says, just give me a copy of the mail from the server. And I use Apple Mail periodically, run it, so it will pop all my Gmail down and fill its Apple Mail database. But, of course, I don't trust Apple Mail as far as I can throw it. So that's just one thing I do. The main thing I do, once per year on a calendar, you know, reminder that I think it's sometime in December, I use the very good Google Takeout feature that allows you to download data, your Google data, onto your computer, and Google will make you a tarball, tar.gz file, of all your Gmail on demand whenever you want it. And I do that once a year. And that gives me all my, I think it's in like Mbox format or whatever. So worst case, and then of course, once those are files, they're in my backup Vortex and they get backed up or whatever. So worst case scenario, I'm going to lose on average 6 months of mail, assuming my Apple Mail thing totally doesn't work at all, which again, I'm not sure I entirely trust it. So those are my strategies. Pop from Gmail using a mail client that I don't actually use for mail, and I just launch Apple Mail every once in a while and just let it run in the background and then quit it, right? Because it catches up pretty quickly. And then Google Takeout. I suggest everybody who uses Gmail as their main email thing, put a reminder in your calendar once a year, once every 6 months, whatever you're comfortable with, to download all your Gmail. You can set the options. It will give you a single file, a single multi-gigabyte file, depending on how much mail you have. It compresses really well, so gzip compression will get it down pretty small because it's mostly text. And that's what I suggest. And then, yeah, that put that file into your own personal backup Vortex and have it go on Time Machine and your super duper clone and your cloud backup, the whole nine yards.
Severin writes, do you use iMessage contact key verification? I just stumbled upon it in settings in iOS 17.2.1. I've never seen it before. So in short, this is a mechanism by which you can verify that the people you are talking to or the people they claim to be, you can do a manual contact key verification by way of getting a key and then over like FaceTime or a phone call, whatever, you read your two keys and verify that they're what you expect. I don't use this because I don't think anyone's going to like man in the middle me for state secrets. Like, I just don't think I'm important enough. But I don't know. Do you guys use this? Let's start with Marco again.
No, for the same reasons. I mean, I didn't know about it until fairly recently. But cause I think it's a pretty recent thing. I think it's iOS 17.2 that added it. But I don't really have the need for this level of security like in my iMessage. Now, you know, if this becomes easy and on by default and everything, then sure, yeah. But, you know, for the same reason I don't use that like ultra lockdown protection mode of iOS. I forget what that's called. Lockdown mode, is that it?
Yeah, I know what you're thinking of. Yeah.
So I don't use that either for the same reason that, like, you know, I don't really deal with data that sensitive or am that big of a target. But if I were dealing with very sensitive stuff, if I was like a whistleblower or a journalist or, you know, like that would be different, then I would be very happy these features are here. But the way it is now, I don't need them.
John?
I do actually want to try it with somebody because I want to see how onerous it is. It seems kind of onerous. Like, it seems like a burden that you would not want to deal with unless it was, like, super important. Like Marco said, like, you're in an actual secure situation where you want to make sure you're talking to who you think you're talking to. I just wanted to see what that burden was. Do you have to like use some side channel to do something? Is it done all through the phone? I was willing to try it, but I haven't found anyone to try it with. So I currently do not have this enabled or used at all.
Sure enough.
And related to that, 17.3 is out now, iOS 17.3, and it has the stolen device protection, and I turned it on. I turned it on my phone, and I had my wife update hers and turns it on her phone, and I'm trying to get my kids to turn it on. Have you guys turned it on?
I haven't yet, but I probably should.
I have it, and I'm doing Tiff's phone probably this weekend with it, because that's one of those things where, like, because, like, she can access our shared bank account and stuff, like, I feel like this is, like, a family IT security policy thing that is worth, you know, closing all the doors on.
Well, they can still get to your bank account. They just can't take over your Apple ID.
Well, but again, it's a high risk enough situation, and also her passcode hygiene is not great. anyway,
yeah, I mean, the reason I did it on my wife's phone is, remember, the family photo library is on her Apple ID. Now with the great shared library feature, I get access to all of them, but technically it's her Apple ID. So having her Apple ID get taken over is really the worst case scenario, not mine. Although I have all the purchases, so we'd lose all the movies. But honestly, I'd much rather lose the movies than the photos. So yeah, I want her to have Stolen Device Production on.
Thanks to our sponsor this week, Squarespace. And thank you to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. And we will talk to you next week.
You have a post-show?
I can hear in my voice, I can hear that I might be losing the battle to all these kid viruses that are going around.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They're just human viruses. They're just carried by children.
Yes, there's
if only they were just kid viruses and only infected children. Alas, they do not.
Yes, all viruses are kid viruses, and they just occasionally infect adults as well.
Ugh. Has Adam or Tiff shown any enthusiasm for the Vision Pro?
Adam, because he is so into the Quest 3, yeah, he's so into that he has requested that I please let him try it. Tiff doesn't care at all. And even
does
Adam,
Adam
like,
know that there's no controllers?
Yes. And because he's a big fan of... because there are... So the Quest 2, some games could use like just hand recognition. The Quest 3, based on what he's told me, it seems like that has gotten better. But not every game will use it. So he still uses the controllers. Because, you know, it makes sense. I can understand why, like, for gaming purposes, controllers are generally a better option. You know, because you want the higher precision, you want maybe more buttons, you know, because most of the gesture recognition on these systems, it can do like a handful of gestures, no pun intended, but it's not doing like every single finger individually, you know, stuff like that. So
and latency is better with controllers, presumably.
Yeah, I would assume so. And you know, when you look at the Vision Pro, it's very clear that this is a device that's made for computing first and games maybe second.
Or not at all.
Right, exactly. Whereas, like, you know, the Quest is a game console.
And so, to be fair to Apple, like, you can just use, like, a PlayStation controller with the Vision Pro. Like, that's their solution, essentially. Oh, you want to play a game in the Vision Pro? Just literally use your Xbox or PlayStation controller, right? Which is not the same thing as a VR controller, which, like in the Valve games, like, oh, you have a virtual hand and you're reaching out to grab the ladder or the gun or the bottle. Like, that's not a thing that Apple is showing or promising at all. It's more like, oh, you can put something in front of you and here, hold the PlayStation controller, now you get low latency, fast access to buttons.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but it seems like, you know, the way Apple has designed the Vision Pro, they want it to be a computer. And that is a very different set of priorities and a very different set of choices than game consoles. The Quest series, those are game consoles first that Facebook keeps trying to make computers, and they're not very good, but they're game consoles. And, you know, and all this stuff that the Vision Pro does that's not games, Adam doesn't care. He might someday, but he doesn't now. It's not his job. He's 11.
He might like the movie thing or the panorama. Like, imagine if they have, like, you're riding on a roller coaster or immersive experience thing. That would be fun to do. Like, when I'm thinking about games and the Vision Pro, all that resolution that's good for looking at, like, your documents is not good for games. Games don't want to push that many pixels. They want high frame rates, and you can't get high frame rates in a, you know, a headset type thing with a low power SoC and GPU on there. And so not having so many pixels to push is an advantage to those less expensive ones. But yeah, the only thing I can think of where it would be an advantage is, oh, you're on a roller coaster. That you might want to see in like HDR, you know, 4K for each eyeball.
Yeah, but like, I feel like I would think that's amazing. I don't think Adam would, like, he would just be like, okay, that's cool. And then he would just go back
to his
game.
Show him the Gerbils demo from QuickDraw 3D. Neither one of you knows what that is.
No.
Nope.
Do you know what QuickDraw 3D is?
I know what QuickDraw, that was like the toolbox functions in the original Mac that made fast window drawing stuff, right?
Yeah, it was the drawing API. It's like, you know, like Core Graphics is now, yeah. QuickDraw was.
So what
Core
was
Graphics,
QuickDraw
but for,
3D?
Yeah, so QuickDraw 3D was at a certain point, and this is the time when Apple did its quote-unquote most serious push into gaming. They made libraries for gaming stuff called game sprockets. They had input sprockets and a bunch of other sprockets for like handling joysticks and you know, doing game type stuff. And they had a 3D API, you know, like instead of OpenGL or DirectX or whatever, and they called it QuickDraw 3D. And it was you know, it was a 3D API just like all those other ones I described, except for much, much worse. And and made by Apple. And one of the demos they had for it, like in a typical Apple fashion, once they came up with QuickDraw 3D, they're like, it works everywhere. There used to be a desk accessory called the Scrapbook. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Nope.
You'd go to the Apple menu, you'd pick Scrapbook, and it was just basically an application with a bunch of like a horizontal scroll bar and a bunch of different things. And what could you put in the scrapbook? Anything you wanted. You could paste in text. You could paste in images. You could paste in a movie. And once QuickDraw 3D came out, you could paste in 3D objects. So you'd get a Mac with QuickDraw 3D, and you'd open the scrapbook, and there would be a 3D model of a palm tree that you could rotate. Anyway, one of the things they had, I believe it was a demo application called Gerbils, I think, and it was a QuickDraw 3D application that modeled, I believe, a bunch of supposedly furry gerbils riding on a roller coaster in 3D. If you can find a movie of what gerbils look like, it is the most hilariously not impressive to young people thing you've ever seen in your life, and the frame rates were awful. I don't think there was any 3D hardware acceleration either, so it was all in software. Not an impressive experience, but if someone can port gerbils to the Apple Vision Pro, I guarantee a bunch of old people like me, if I actually had a Vision Pro, will buy it for 99 cents and try it.
Oh my God. Yeah, so they'll sell like 12 copies.
Right. Yeah, yeah, no, it's a big market for gerbils.
All right, we done?
Yeah, that's good. We're short today.
Hey, I'm not complaining.
An hour 35.
I know.
Sometimes it happens. Let me see. If it might have been QuickDraw 3D Rave was like the hardware acceleration thing, I think.
I was just looking at QuickDraw 3D, and Rave is definitely mentioned many times within this article on
Wow, this thing that's showing this YouTube video that someone posted, let me tell you, this is not how it looked on a Mac, because this is like... whatever, this has got to be like either running an emulation or running on the fastest Mac ever. I never got these frame rates for these amazing graphics. Look at these graphics.
Oh, wow.
It's not great. This is what David Schaub and Chris Finasso put in. I mean, the frame rate is pretty good.
I never saw those frame rates.
It looks, this is probably running under some kind of emulation, but like it does look like, you know, the 3D demos of the time. Like they were very impressive for the time. Man, look at those terrible shadows. Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, it was grim. Like, even at the time, though, because you knew what 3D was supposed to look like on a PC game, and eventually, like, with the Voodoo cards, like, actual hardware acceleration, this was not that.
Well, that's why
it didn't catch on.
I really didn't, like, I think part of what made me fall out of video games, like, around the era of the 32-bit systems, is that I really, with the exception of the N64, which did a much nicer job of 3D, the like early 3D stuff, it just looked way worse than the best 2D stuff of the time. So yeah, it seemed we took a big step backwards for a while.
You should look at there's some good tech videos about the PlayStation, like the original PlayStation, the PlayStation 1. What its limitations were in terms of 3D, there were like fundamental things that you need to do 3D graphics that it just couldn't do. So the games just looked not good.
Yeah, didn't it not do Z ordering, so you had to like manually.
It didn't do perspective correct texturing. Yeah, it was like there was such fundamental limits, and that's why like PlayStation 1 games look like PlayStation 1 games. And then N64, everything looked like a blurry soup, but at least they had, you know, correct 3D. They just had textures that were incredibly low resolution, and they loved smearing them. And very few polygons. Have I talked about the guy who has been slowly rewriting Mario 64?
I've heard about it, yeah, because apparently it was so inefficiently written, and there were a whole bunch of problems.
It wasn't inefficiently written. It's just that if you have 30 years to work on it, you can make improvements. Like, you know, people disassembled it, and then they like sort of symbolically disassembled it. So now they have Mario 64 source code that is not the source code, but it is source codes that humans can understand. And he's been working on it, just chiseling away, like, how can I make it faster? And so, like, on native N64 hardware, it runs like double the frame rate and can push so many more polygons. Which is like I admired the dedication, but in the end it just looks like Mario 64.
That's funny. It looks like Mario 64 to you, because for me it looks like Mario 64.
I know, I get it. Yeah.
I can't help it. I had supple lenses is pretty good. Big market for gerbils is the after show, but that is funny.
Do you have supple lenses, Casey? I think you do, right? Because your hard contacts are...
Oh, they're not supple. They're many things, but supple.
Isn't that what the hard contacts are doing? Is squishing your eyeballs?
No, not really. What they're actually doing is they're putting a layer of tears between the cornea and and the lens of the RGPs, the rigid gas permeable lenses, such that the combination of the exterior lens and that tear stuff makes the front of my eye kind of normal-ish.
Interesting. So the liquid ends up as serving as part of the lens?
Again, everything I'm telling you may be dead wrong, and I just don't realize it. But that is my understanding.
You put them in your eyes, you can see.
Exactly.
That's the important part.
Which actually, it's funny because, you know, a lot of people pointed out to me, which was actually very kind. I didn't think that many people could remember or gave a crap that I wear hard contacts. But a fair number of people wrote to me when Mac Rumors was like, hey, Apple says you can't use hard contacts. And as I briefly mentioned on the show, you know, when I was going through the purchase process, I was like, well, let me be honest, even though I don't think it'll be a problem. And let's just say I'm pretty sure it won't be a problem.
I feel like you can say this. We know you went to a lab. At the lab, he put it on his face.
I didn't say that, Apple. I didn't say it.
Oh, no. The secrets have been revealed. Right. You mean you used Vision Pro at the lab?
What? No. But anyways.
You can't say that.
So I saw this post from Mac Rumors, and I saw what the store said, because the store was like, dude, we can't help you if you wear hard contacts. And I think the assumption on Apple's part was that I would need too strong a power. I think we saw Cable Sasser was in a situation, or is in a situation, where Zeiss doesn't feel like they can service his particular eye needs because he needs like such a strong, you know, power or whatever. And so then I went through it a second time, and that's probably part of the reason I didn't get an 8 o'clock appointment, but rather woe is me, an 8:30 appointment. But anyways, so I had to go back through it again and just be like, no, I can see great. I promise. It's cool. It's fine. Just go. And then it was no problem. But yeah, that was very kind of you who reached out and were worried about hard contacts with the Vision Pro. But let's just say I'm fairly confident it'll be all right. Anyway, titles.
I like the supple lenses one.
That is very good.
I also like adding some carrot.
I like put me on a mountaintop, although mountaintop is one word.
Oh, where's that?
Towards the bottom.
I suggested it, but I liked the amount you can squish, which was also
eye-related. Title before.
No, have it?
Yeah.
I like adding some carrot. It sounds like cooking.
That's true. I also suggested see my computerized eyeballs. I thought that was pretty funny.
Where are your parents
from? I like adding some carrot, too. Yeah, adding some carrot and...
carrot from?
It was the carrot in the stack.
Yes. I personally think supple lenses is a little bit better, especially because it's about Vision Pro, but I would not veto adding some carrot.
Yeah, I'm good with either of those.
All right, let's do carrot then, because I don't like the lenses one.
All right, cool. That was easy.
We're
gonna get to bed tonight before 10 o'clock.
I know. I am very happy about this because Daddy didn't get a nap today, and so I'm sleepy.
Poor you.
I usually try on ATP days. I usually try to get a little snooze in, and I did not have the chance.
This would be a lesson to me because I did cut off some follow up, and I'm like, we don't have time. We got so much stuff, but I cut
oh no,
in.
John, this is not the lesson you should take.
The
from
last
this.
Thing this episode needs
Good
is
God.
More follow up.
Yep.
Well, no. We have more topics too, but we didn't have time for any of the big ones that are there. Right?
Oh my God.
No regrets. No. I have no ragrats.
Yeah.
This is fine. I also have a couple of things I need to talk to you two privately about. So goodbye, live people. Thanks for being live people.
Cool. Bye, live people. See you next time.